Well, good morning, folks.
Good morning.
We are in Mark. I'm going to find Mark's gospel. We're in Mark chapter 9, specifically. If this thing will wake up, let's try this. While we're paused here for a brief moment of technical difficulty, let me give a little love to Brian Rapp over here. Not very good at keeping the website sermons up to speed. Those of you who look there know that to be the case. And Brian, it turns out, is much better at it than I. He is now handling that for us. Thank you. I appreciate that. If you check out our website, you'll find, hey, what do you know? It's actually up to date. So that's good. That's the way it's supposed to be, and that's good. We are in Mark chapter 9, dealing with a kind of a vexing text in some ways. There's some things about this that don't really make sense when you first read them right off the page, and I'm hoping that we can kind of talk through those this morning. As is my habit, I want to read the text for you, and then we will pray and see how God will reveal himself here. Mark chapter 9, beginning in verse 14. And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them, scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" Someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. And when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. It has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible for one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe. Help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out. And the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he'd entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer." Father, thanks for your word. Thanks for a chance to study your word. Thanks for using Mark and so many other authors to preserve your word and make it say just exactly what it should and nothing that it should not. Give us wisdom this morning as we move through this passage, seeking to understand it, and more importantly, seeking to better understand you. Pray that as we do so, Lord, you'd be glorified. Amen. Okay, now, from last time, of course, we were talking transfiguration. And it's worth noting that this miracle falls directly on the heels of the transfiguration, because nothing's quite the same as what it was before. Right? We've seen these miracles where somebody comes along and there's something wrong with them and the servant, Jesus, comes forward and heals them. And that, we've seen a lot of that, actually, in Mark's gospel. But all of a sudden, it feels like things should be different. We've had this transfiguring moment when the real glory of the Son of God has been on display for the people, and they come down from that experience, and it kind of feels like one of the same old, and yet it's not, guys, and we're going to see that this morning. I want to encourage you from last time. The words on that screen are well intended, that they are a reminder. The transfiguration, the formation of Jesus in all of his glory, for however brief a moment that was, with his three disciples and recorded for us to remember, should remind us of his majesty and his power and his authority, but maybe more than anything, remind us that we are to listen to him and to obey him. But as I've said, this context this morning is really, really interesting. So the transfiguration has just happened. And it is this, really literally mind-blowing, truly awesome experience for these three men. And they didn't even know what to do. Remember the Bible said Peter's just saying kind of silly stuff because he's terrified. He doesn't know what to say. And he's asking silly questions like, hey, should we build tents for you guys or what? He's sort of dumbstruck. The other two disciples apparently say nothing. And they're coming down off of that experience. They're coming down the mountain and they want to understand. And so they're asking questions, although as we saw last week, the question's at least a little silly. Rather than asking about the heart of the matter, the suffering of Jesus and his resurrection, they're asking questions about other people, but they're seeking to understand, and they're coming down this mountain. Okay, now the mountains of Jerusalem aren't like the Rocky Mountains, right? So it's not like they're way up there and they can't see anybody down below, but they're up there in this high place, and they're coming down, and as they get down the mountainside, they discover what we read in verse 14, that there's this crowd gathered around the other disciples. So James, John, Peter up there with Jesus. And so the four of them are coming down this mountain, and then there's this big old crowd of people. And boy, it seems a little commotion. Seems to be a little hotly contested something going on. They're arguing about something. And so you have to immediately shift gears if you're Peter or if you're James or if you're John. And all of a sudden, I've been having these great conversations with Jesus, and he's pointing me toward what I'm supposed to be looking at, and we're thinking and we're working through this, and I've had this vision. I've seen Christ in all of his great glory, and now we're just, boom, right back into the midst of the arguing and the debating with the scribes, and oh man, what is going on? And so when they came, verse 14, to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them, scribes, arguing. And then, rather interesting words, immediately, all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed. Why? I mean, really, it's possible that maybe this is a crowd of people that has never personally seen Jesus before. Maybe, right? He's traveled a lot, and so maybe he's traveled here to a group of people that just hasn't actually seen Jesus yet, hasn't actually met Jesus yet. But we haven't seen this before. When strangers meet Jesus, they're excited. That's true. When strangers meet Jesus, they come to him with questions. That's true. When strangers meet Jesus, they approach him with reverence. They call him master. They call him teacher. They call him rabbi, something like that. That's true. But they saw him and they were greatly amazed. Why? Well, the scripture don't tell us for sure, but we do have at least one other example of someone shining with the complete radiant glory of God, and then incidentally coming down off a mountaintop themselves. And of course, we're talking about Moses. And so if we were to go all the way back to Exodus 34 and look at Moses up there in his mountaintop experience, seeing the true, what the Hebrew word is, Shekinah, this true awesome glory of God, do you remember what happened to him when he came back down off the mountaintop? It was like glowy. There was something about his countenance that was amazing, that was remarkable. In fact, the text even goes on to talk about how he kind of put like a veil in front of his face. And again, I want to be a little cautious because Mark here doesn't say that, and yet he does say that something is different because these people are amazed at Jesus. Like he just went up to a mountaintop and came back down. There's nothing to be amazed about that action. So what are they amazed at? Maybe, just maybe, there's still a little bit of something left about him that they can sense in him, but there's something's different. This isn't the just same old guy, the same old preacher guy that I thought he was. Maybe they've never seen him before, maybe they have seen him before, but there's something amazing in this case about his presence. What I want you to notice next as we move through the next few verses here is look at the condition of the various people in this story. When we meet them, there's actually a number of people in this tale that when we meet them, Mark actually tells us a little bit about their condition. For example, we find the condition of the son, right? Did you see that there in the text? He says, my son has a spirit that makes him mute. It seizes him. It throws him down. He foams and he grinds his teeth and he becomes rigid and stiff, like he's having what you and I would describe as epileptic seizures, grand mal kind of seizures. And on top of that, he's mute. And if we notice down there in verse 25, Jesus calls this a deaf and mute spirit. So the boy, and we don't know exactly how old he is, but the Greek word means usually a youngish boy, not a little toddler, but you know, perhaps somebody of 9 or 10 years. He is deaf and he is mute and he is apparently somewhat regularly lashed into, thrown into these just awful epileptic seizures. You ever been around? I hope you haven't, because it's actually a little bit scary. You ever been around somebody that's had an experience like that? A friend of mine growing up I got instruction on you need to take your wallet out, Nathan, and put it in his mouth so that he doesn't incidentally bite his tongue real badly or something. That's what we want you. I know it's scary. You know, I'm 9 years old. Like, yeah, that's scary. But if it ever happens, Nathan, you need to get your wallet out and put it in his mouth. Right? Only once did Travis ever have a pretty bad seizure. But if you've never seen that, man, that's just terrifying. I have never had one of my children have that experience. Probably none of you has. But this guy, this father, notice his condition. Desperate, probably an understatement. Right? This father doesn't know what else to do. It's been this way as long as anybody can remember. And again, the kids, I mean, he could be, the Greek word there, maybe the child is 4 or 5, maybe he's 9 or 10. Years, in any event, his son has been this way. Odds are good this father's tried a little bit of everything. You would, wouldn't you? And here he comes and he hears of a man, Jesus, who heals people, this great servant who heals people. And so he comes, seeking Jesus. Maybe, just maybe, Jesus can do something. Okay. Well, then he gets there, and all he finds are the disciples. There are 9 of them anyway. And aren't you the disciples of Jesus? Yeah. Well, he's up in the mountaintop right now, but yeah, well, how can we help you? And he describes the situation. And his disciples, who have been given authority to do so, his disciples who have been told, you're going to cast out demons in my name, all right, we can do this. Well, yeah, we can help you out. We're going to cast out this demon, and they can't. And moreover, we read at the end of the text, they're really confused about that. They ask him, why couldn't we cast out this demon? This is actually one of the more vexing parts of this text. Lots of people have kind of wondered and pondered, going, what? I don't understand. Jesus told them they were going to be able to cast out demons, and they're not able to cast out demons, and what? As we'll see here in a minute, Matthew's account makes it even a little more confusing for some people. So we find the disciples, 3 of them, coming down off that mountaintop experience, are seeking understanding, and they're having this great conversation with Jesus, and then the others are down there in this crowd of people, and they're, oh yeah, we could totally do this. We could cast out this demon, and then wait, no, we can't. Why can't we? And the desperate father wonders, no doubt, the same. Then, of course, they always seem to show up at the wrong times. Our friends, the scribes. I've explained before, guys, they really do mean well. These scribes really did mean well. They thought they were the guardians and protectors of the law. They thought, since the land and the king and the temple were kind of in a little chaos, that we got the law, it's what we got left, we're going to hold on to the law. They really thought they were doing well. They thought they meant well, but it doesn't make them any less wrong. The scribes, I don't think I'm reading between the lines here. Doesn't it seem to you that the scribes are actually kind of a little bit glad that the disciples couldn't heal this boy? They're sitting there arguing, debating. Meanwhile, you got a child who's deaf and mute and prone to life-threatening seizures. And you're here over here arguing the fine points of your theology. Jesus, understandably, is indignant. This makes some people uncomfortable. Let's acknowledge that. This makes some people a little uncomfortable. Look at the text again if you missed it the first time around. We'll pick up there in 17. Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And he explains, and he says, I asked your disciples, and they weren't able. And the first words out of Jesus' mouth in verse 19, oh, faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Doesn't really fit the standard mold of, you know, exceptionally compassionate Jesus who wants to be our best friend and hold our hand through life's difficulties. Well, this is seems a little indignant, Jesus. This seems a little angry, maybe even. And one of the great questions is, who exactly is he talking to? Right? He surely isn't talking to this father per se, because he says faithless generation. He's not just talking to the dad. Some people have argued that he's actually talking to his disciples, that he's turning to those nine and saying, dude, come on, what are you doing? I don't know. I think it seems more consistent with the way Jesus uses these words in the rest of Mark's Gospels to believe that he's talking to these scribes. That he's saying to these scribes, are you kidding me? There's a boy here in desperate need of help. And you're using this as an opportunity to argue and to debate, to complain, to point fingers? No. How long am I going to have to put up with you people? And there is righteous indignation in the world. I hope you're aware of that. Lots of people, lots of times Christians struggle with this idea. There's this idea bouncing around in the world that, well, I'm a Christian, therefore I can't ever get angry. Well, I don't know about that. Right? We see Jesus here righteously indignant. The Bible itself says, be angry, but don't sin. So I can be angry and it not be sin? I mean, let's be honest. Most of the time you're angry, you probably are in sin. Most of the time I'm angry, I probably am in sin. But it doesn't have to be that way. Here, Jesus seems at least a little bit angry, and he's indignant at the sort of spiritual dullness and deadness of these scribes. And then, of course, let's not leave out the other actor in this story, the demon. Did you catch that? I'm always amazed at just the power of Jesus. Look at verse 20. They brought the boy to Jesus, and when the demon saw him, Jesus, immediately it freaked out. It convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground, rolling about, foaming at the mouth. We think of, rightfully, correctly, we think of demons as really scary, right? Like, one of the things I will never for the life of me understand is why people make movies about demon possession. Like, I don't understand that. I don't get that. Like, that's one of the more terrifying things in human experience. And yet there are people out there that, I guess, find some kind of shock value? I don't know. I don't understand it. We rightfully understand that demons are really powerful, pretty scary things. And this really powerful, pretty scary thing just absolutely loses it in the presence of Jesus. He's powerless, as we'll see. I take great comfort in that. I also find interesting, did you catch this? I want to take a little side note here. I don't understand. I just said I don't understand how it is that people make movies about demon possession. Let me tell you something else I don't understand. I do not understand how there are people in the world who have been duped into thinking that there are spirits out there that want to help you out. Like, I don't, you know, these people call themselves various names, right? And you'll meet these people. You probably will. Like, odds are really good there's at least a handful of them here in this area. I've met some. I'm Wiccan. I'm sorry, what? I'm Wiccan. Oh, so you believe that there's a mother goddess that is infusing you with power? Yeah, I follow the ancient druidic path, or I'm a pagan, by which they usually mean they worship spirits, or the all-time famous one, the Hollywood famous one, is Voden, or what we call voodoo. Yeah, the greatest honor I could possibly have is to be possessed by some spirit, because they'll help me out. And then to add insult to injury, it seems to me amazing that Walt Disney Company made that into a little kid's princess movie, right? Was it Princess and the Frog? Is that what the thing's called? Like, are you kidding me? We're gonna Disney-fy voodoo possession. Okay. Actually, no, it's not okay. It is amazing to me how many people have been duped into thinking that there are these spiritual forces in the world that through the use of a Ouija board or through the use of a seance or through some Wiccan, you know, religious idea or through some crystal they're hanging about their neck, that these things are they're going to help us. I've got these guardian spirits. They're going to help us out. Is that what was happening here? Okay, are you kidding me? Did you catch that? He says the dad nails it. Jesus asked him, how long has this been happening to him? And the father says, from childhood. and it has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. There's a thing, there's a creature, there is a spiritual being inside my child, and it's trying to kill him. And the Father's powerless to do anything about it. But Jesus isn't. Jesus is most certainly not. Amazing. Don't ever get tricked into that, guys. Satan, the Church of Satan, says the same thing. There's these spiritual forces out there that you can tap into and give you power. Like, that is not what they want. What they want is what we're told in 1 Peter. What they want is just what the same what the devil wants. To devour you. Not to help you. Now, on to another little side point. I think there's something really sad happening in this text that we would miss. Until you read it and read it and read it and think through it, I think we'd miss this. The Father says this has been from childhood. It's seeking to destroy him. And then the Father says, but if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Why does he say that? I mean, my friends, we've seen miracle after miracle after miracle. This man's probably heard about miracle after miracle after miracle. This man is desperate and hears stories of a Jesus who can heal people. Why does he now come and say, if? In fact, Jesus is going to challenge that and say, if you can. And the man says, I believe. I have faith, and then it says, help my unbelief. We'll get to that in a moment. Why does he here say, if? And I want to suggest that the great Puritan preacher Matthew Henry was onto something. The great Puritan preacher Matthew Henry said this. In this passage, based on this text, he said, thus Christ suffers in his honor by the difficulties and follies of his disciples. Wait, what? Yeah, because you see, Dad came to the disciples who are representing Jesus. And they represented Jesus poorly. They represented him badly. And this man who doesn't know Jesus, all he knows about Jesus is the disciples. And he sees in the disciples a lack of power and therefore wonders, is there also a lack of power in Jesus? Seems an honest enough question. Christ suffers in his honor by the difficulties and follies of his disciples. And let's be honest, we've done the same. You're an ambassador, guys. Y'all know I am an ambassador. Okay, we represent Jesus. You've heard it said that you're probably the only Jesus certain people will ever know. You're it. When people know that you're following Christ, they kind of expect you to act like Christ would act. And when we represent him poorly, among many other things, the honor of Christ suffers. Now, let's get to the heart of the matter here. The real heart of this story is about faith, guys. Let's talk about the importance of faith, shall we? Beginning in verse 23, Jesus said to him, If you can, all things are possible for one who believes. And immediately the father of the child cried out and said, I believe. Help my unbelief. Okay, things to note. Number one, I mentioned this a few weeks ago. This is absolutely positively not the word of faith kind of faith that we're talking about. Now, if that doesn't mean anything to you, let me explain very simply. There's a category of preachers in America today, mostly in America, a few other places too. They call themselves word of faith preachers, and they say, we're Christian. Mike and I have great doubts about that. They say, we're Christian, and then they say, faith is a force. Okay, so you should be thinking like Star Wars or something here. Faith is a force. Words are the containers of that force. And so by speaking the right words, you can create your own reality. Which actually starts to sound a lot like Star Wars or Harry Potter or something else. It sounds far more like I have the power. And I, because of me, I can make things happen. Okay, once upon a time, there was a cartoon film called The Prince of Egypt. It's got a lovely soundtrack, and as many of you know, my daughter's smiling now. The most famous song from that film is there can be miracles when you believe. What? As if somehow I am the object of this? I don't know about that. You think at the parting of the Red Sea, you think God on high looked down and said, okay, guys, I'm fixing to do something really miraculous. Any of y'all believe me? No? All right. Sorry. So we are absolutely, positively not talking about sort of word of faith kind here. And then I also want to dispel another myth. You've probably got friends that say things like, you know, I'm glad you're a person of faith. I'm just not. And then they'll usually throw a little insult on there. They'll go, well, you know, I'm a person of science. I love that one too. Here's the thing. I love this. Do this the next time one of your friends says this. Do this little exercise and then just watch the gears turn. This is fun. This is what I do. I say, no, you're a person of faith too. No, I'm not. And usually these are people we're sitting down someplace. So I will say to them, I know you're a person of faith. And you know how I know? Because when you walked in and you sat down, you did not approach the chair, inspect the chair, verify that the chair seems sturdy enough to hold your weight, gingerly test it, and then finally sat down. You didn't do that. You walked in the room, you saw a chair, and you had faith that the chair is designed to hold me up. It'll hold me up. I can sit down. You also didn't check the ceiling. You didn't ask for an architectural plan to make sure that the beams are not bearing too much load. Like, every single one, can you imagine? You couldn't move through life without faith. You have faith that the sun's going to come up every morning. What if you didn't? Yikes. You have faith that the sky is in fact not going to fall. What if you didn't? I mean, really, truly, you have faith that that pill, whatever that medicine is, that little pill that you take once a day or once a week, whatever, you have faith that that thing is actually going to help you. What if tomorrow it just decides to become poison? Well, you have faith that it won't. We put faith in all manner of things. Every single person, to be human is to be a person of faith. So please don't let your friends use that. You know, you're a person of faith, and I'm glad for you, but yes, you are. Everybody's a person of faith. So the million-dollar question is, what is the object of your faith? Are you putting faith in your own powers of observation? Well, sitting in a chair, maybe that's safe. But you guys have seen enough in life to know that our powers of observation aren't all that great. I watched with my kids every once in a while, we watch this show, it's called Brain Games. If you've never seen it, I commend it to you. Brain Games is about all the different ways that our brain works and sometimes doesn't work. There was one entire episode where they were trying to prove that we're not as observant as we think we are. And so they staged a crime and then they asked a whole bunch of people who were eyewitnesses. Literally, they were just right there and saw it happen. They asked people to recount. And like, nobody's the same. Nothing is consistent. People saw all kinds of things that weren't even there. So you putting your faith in your own powers of observation? I hope it's more than that in life. Are you putting your faith in the idea that you as a human being, you know, let's imagine, I'll use your cup here for a second, Isaac. Let's imagine that this cup represents all knowledge that is out there. Everything knowable is inside this cup. Okay? How much of it do you personally know? Is there a word for a unit that small? I don't know. Is that a micron? I don't know. I mean, how much of that do you know? Let's just assume you're incredibly smart. You're smarter than all the rest of us put together. Let's assume that you actually know maybe, I don't know, like that much of it. So you're going to put your faith that in the tiny bit that you know, nowhere else in there is God. This is what your atheist friends do. Your atheist friends say, I am so confident in the itsy bitsy bit of knowledge that I have that I am willing to gamble that in the entire rest of it, there is no God. You're putting your faith in that? You putting your faith in some other religion? Well, you know, all religions are the same. Are you kidding me? Study some of the world's other religions and you'll see that's nonsense. Islam, how dare you? Islam, the second most popular religion in the world, preacher. How can you say those people are all wrong? I don't know. Are you aware of the fact that the Quran says that Jesus didn't actually die? It wasn't him on the cross. It was a dude that looked like him. Despite all the Jewish, Christian, Roman, and otherwise evidence to the contrary, the Quran insists that it was a Jesus lookalike. So it was like a celebrity impersonator up there on the cross. You can put your faith in that? No, it's a question of the object of our faith. And then I also find it really, really humbling that this man, this father, who is in so many ways a great example for us today, of all the people in today's story, I'm going to suggest the father is maybe the single best role model, not the disciples, sad to say. He's got that faith to say, I believe. But then he also has the humility to say, but not like I should. Help my unbelief. This father has enough self-awareness, enough humility, enough honesty with himself to say, you know what, I do believe right now in this moment, Jesus, that you can do something. But I don't believe as well as I should. I don't believe as much as I should. I don't believe as often as I should. You ever pray that way? Lord, grow my faith. Make me more. Make me trust in you more. Give me more faith. It's a little bit of a dangerous prayer. We preachers like to use that expression, dangerous prayer. Because who knows what God's going to do if you pray that way. Then notice, please, that there is absolute, complete, total healing from the servant. Where the disciples were completely inept, they were completely unable, Jesus is completely, thoroughly equipped and able. At first you might say, well, but wait a minute, boy, that demon, he put up a real good fight. And then you go, actually, not really. Right? Remember this? Look at the text there again. It has often thrown him into the fire to destroy him, but if you can do anything, and then Jesus says, if, all things are possible, and they bring the child, and Jesus sees that this great crowd has come, he rebukes the unclean spirit, saying to it, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. So what does the demon do? And the demon cries out, convulses, and then, hey, guess what? Obeys the second person of the Trinity. Because that is just the way it works. And I also find it remarkable that Jesus literally just speaks words. Right? Like, y'all, if you've ever seen any of them goofy movies, you know, the people like using magic incantations and they got holy water and there's always like a crucifix or something. Every demon possession movie I've ever seen little clips of always looks the same. Jesus comes along, Jesus goes, here's how it is, spirit, get out. And the spirit gets out. We're talking about the second person of the Trinity. Like, there's no arguing. This scary, terrifying, demonic thing, we're done. We're not arguing. We can't. It's Jesus said, I got to go, so I got to go. The end. Now, juxtapose that with what we looked at last week. Okay? Those of you going, juxta what? Juxtapose. Set two things side by side and compare them. Okay? Juxtapose that with what we looked at last week. What did the voice from heaven say we're supposed to do regarding Jesus? Listen to him. What did this demon have no choice but to do? Listen to him. This demon has absolutely no power to do otherwise. It's remarkable. So shaken is the boy, though, that the crowd thinks he's dead. Like, I've not had that experience. Some of you in the medical profession, you probably have. My guess is if you're a nurse or a doctor, maybe you've had that experience where you actually thought this patient's going to die. Maybe you thought this patient is dead until you learn better. Death is a great question. How do you define death? All right, well, today we tend to go on brainwave activity. Help me out, medical people, if I'm wrong. We mostly say brains about brainwave activity. Right. Once upon a time, it was real easy. You know how forever and ever and ever and ever, you know how they determined whether you were dead? The doctors carried a wee little piece of glass with them or a wee little mirror with them. And they just held it up to you. And they look. And if there's a little fog, you're breathing, you're alive. If there's not, you're dead. I mean, that was it. That was how they defined death. So death was defined as you're not breathing anymore. We then came along and invented this remarkable machine that breathes for you. And we said, well, that's not dead. We can make him keep breathing. He's not dead. He's still got brainwave activity going on, so he's not dead. He's just in a coma. Okay, they don't have that luxury. This boy appears for all intents and purposes to be dead. And then Jesus doesn't just leave him that way. Also find it really cool that Jesus doesn't even say, hey, come on, somebody help that kid up. Haven't I done enough here? No. Jesus takes the boy by the hand, helps him up. And you can imagine the gasp of the crowd. What is it like? I don't want to dwell on this too much because Mark doesn't. But what is it like to be that kid? You're 10 years old and all you've ever known is this thing inside you. And now it's gone. Man, the praise that child no doubt had for Jesus. And then we get to maybe the most vexing part of this story. We get to the moment in the story where we go, wait, what? We couldn't do this. Why couldn't we do this? Why could we not cast it out? And Jesus said, this kind can be driven out or cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. The end. Mark moves on. Like, wait, what? Having a moment rather like this, this is an actual real live road sign in Canada. The locals call this Confusion Corner. Yeah, that's not good. I'm trying to figure that out myself. It's a little confusing, right? Matthew, if we were to turn to Matthew's text, Matthew, when the disciples ask Jesus, why couldn't we cast out this demon? Matthew says, y'all didn't have enough faith. If you even had the faith of a mustard seed, you could move mountains. But then Mark says, well, it's only, you've got to pray. This kind only comes out by prayer. And so the skeptic says, the critic says, you can't trust your Bible. Matthew's got a different version than Mark. Luke, incidentally, doesn't even include this part. Luke doesn't even tell us about the part where the disciples say, how come we couldn't? He just skips that part altogether. Which leaves a lot of people with a lot of confusion. Like, here's the thing. I think what's being said to the disciples is, look, boys, you expected to be able to cast out this demon because I told you you could. And then you tried and you failed. And what did you do? You threw your hands up in the air. You shrugged your shoulders. You grimaced a little. You held a little powwow. What you didn't do was seek me. What you didn't do was seek the Father. What you didn't do was pray. What you did is demonstrated a lack of faith. We tried. Jesus said we could do this. It failed. Oh, man. Wow. I don't understand. Instead of taking that to God in prayer, as Mark puts it, instead of demonstrating their faith by taking it to God in prayer, to put Matthew and Mark together, these disciples got into an argument with the scribes. Meanwhile, the kid's over there suffering. So, faith. The core of this story this morning is faith. Not a magical force, not in a wand, not Harry Potter style, not word of faith style, not slap you on the forehead style. It's not that. And it certainly isn't about a quantity of it that I have. There are people in the world that want to argue that faith is like measurable. That like some people have like, and when you reach this certain quantity of faith, now all of a sudden you can do miraculous things. But there's a problem with that, guys, because it makes the object of faith me and my faith meter. And if I can just build my faith meter up high enough, then I can accomplish things. No, it's not about me. It is always about the object of his faith. How do you know this, preacher? The guy himself says, help me in my unbelief. And Jesus, at this moment, if we had faith meters, Jesus would have said, okay, bud, go out and demonstrate some more faith and come back to me when you've raised up your meter a little bit and then I'll heal your boy. But he doesn't. The man acknowledges some faith, not enough faith, and Jesus heals the kid anyway because it's about the object of our faith, which is Christ. So am I humble enough to acknowledge that I don't always believe the way I should? Am I bold enough to then pray, Lord, help my unbelief? Am I humble enough to acknowledge it and bold enough to ask for help or not? As I said a moment ago, I'm convinced that the dad in this story is maybe the single greatest role model for us here. It's not the disciples. It certainly isn't those scribes. It's not the boy. Jesus, obviously, always. But the father in this story serves as a pretty good role model of a humble, honest faith. Not wielding it like magic. Not counting his meter. Humbly acknowledging the object of his faith is Jesus. Now, interestingly, next week, we'd want, this is not a typo, we would want to say, oh, cool, so we're going to get faith over fear. Yeah, everybody's got that bumper sticker, that sign hanging in their living. Actually, next week, we're going to see fear instead of faith. The disciples are going to model what not to do as we move through some more of Mark chapter 9. Father, thanks for Mark. Thank you for a lesson in faith. Thank you that faith is not some kind of a force that I have to pour more of into my faith meter. Lord, we can and we should grow our faith. You've asked us to be people of faith. And so, Father, like everything else, we lean upon you for that. Building my faith is not something I do, Lord. You're my creator. You're my redeemer. You're my sovereign king. And so, Father, I humbly ask you to grow my faith and grow the faith of these, my friends. Not so that we can then do miraculous things. This isn't about us. Father, it's about your glory. You were glorified in the healing of this boy. Was the boy encouraged? Of course, Father, but you were glorified in the healing of this boy. Father, use us. Use our hands, use our feet, use our mouths. Use our talent, our time, our treasure for your glory. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.